Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Before we begin today's program with Dr. Robert Wald, I'm going to take a second to introduce my co-host for today, licensed clinical social worker Prentice Pemberton. Prentice has been with us before, and he's going to tell you a little bit about some variation that we're going to be providing in Line 1 as an experiment over the next several months. Here's Prentice to tell you a little bit more about it.
Yeah, thanks. Good afternoon. You have to sort of excuse my voice here. I'm under the weather. Everybody at my house is sick. But beginning in March, on Line 1, we're going to commit the fourth Monday of every month, wrapping up in June, to a mental health or psychosocial topic that Dr. Woodard and I will co-host those shows. I'm excited about this opportunity to co-host, I think, on some topics that are going to resonate with a lot of folks out there. Our first official guest, the one that I have confirmed, is Whitney Whitman, who is a LPC here locally. And we're going to talk, that's on the 25th of March, we're going to discuss the process and importance of divorcing well, sort of the collaborative divorce process. Also, as Dr. Woodard will be out of town on March 18th, and I'm gonna guest host the program, and we're going to have sort of a roundtable discussion of different therapists and talk about therapy and some of the common diagnoses and treatment of those. So I'm excited about doing that, and I appreciate you letting me sit in here in the next few months. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, I want to remind everybody, you can always give us your feedback at line1@alaskapublic.org. Let us know what you think of what we're doing and how we might improve things and even topics for programs. I'm looking forward to it. Now let's just press on with the show. Joining Prentice and I in the studio today is child psychiatrist Dr. Robert Wald of Bridges Counseling Connection Center here in Anchorage. Dr. Wald is a dean of pediatric psychiatry. He's got over 50 years, he tells me, of pediatric psychiatric experience, and he is also a past president of the Alaska Psychiatric Association. Our topic today is the diagnosis and treatment of bipolar disorder in the pediatric age group. Dr. Wald, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
Before we get started here, let's remind our listeners that this is a call-in show and that your participation is encouraged and appreciated. You can reach us with your questions or comments in three ways. The local phone number is 550-8433, or you can call toll-free from anywhere you may be listening at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to participate is by emailing your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org.
Dr. Wall, let me start with, if you don't mind, just a observation that, at least in my lifetime as a pediatrician, which is not as long as yours as a child psychiatrist, there has been a dramatic change in the practice of psychiatry as I see it. So let me ask you, is that true? What do you think about the change, and has it been for the best for everybody?
Well, there have been many changes, and some of them I think better than others, but in general the profession itself has expanded in public's awareness, and its value to the community has been generally more accepted than it had been when I first began. That's a positive. There have been some things that I don't consider positives, which include the requirement that treatment be limited as much as it is to more pharmaceutical direction and less of an interpersonal direction. But I think that's a product of the positive of the first level, which is general acceptance of the profession as a whole. However, we've been aided in our work by developing collateral professional groups, social workers and licensed clinicians and so forth, who fundamentally are carrying some of the water for the psychiatrists in terms of dealing with patients over long terms and getting into more material than the economics of contemporary medicine allow psychiatrists to do. So
It's similar, it sounds like, and I hadn't thought about that, to what's happening in medicine, is there's just so much information, so much knowledge, and that requires a lot of experience to be really good at a particular thing, so that a nephrologist, a kidney specialist, is a heck of a lot better than I am at dealing with kidney disease. I know a lot about kidney disease, but I'm not that good at some of the other aspects and certainly some of the details of it. So from a psychiatrist standpoint, the psychiatrists have gotten better at the medication management, but have almost, maybe the word's not correct, defaulted to the social workers, psychologists, so forth, to do the psychotherapies. Possibly because the difficulty of being a jack of all trades?
Well, that's part of it. The fundamental work that all behavioral therapists do has to do with interpersonal relationships, either with the therapist himself or herself, or reflection back to the family. So the training for psychiatrists has changed, and in a sense has been surrendered to psychologists and the parapsychologists in terms of psychiatric social workers and licensed clinical workers and so on. So the fundamental psychodynamic principles are being developed over a broader sweep of training facilities. The work of psychiatrists has been to some degree reduced to psychopharmacologic work, which is, from my point of view, regrettable, but part of the development of our civilization.
Yeah, that's one of the questions that Prentice, I know you may want to ask about the psychosocial stuff, but I'm interested in, as we've moved towards the medications more, was that good or not? And you've implied that's regrettable. I'm suspecting you're saying it's not totally regrettable, but that there may be consequences of that change that may not be as beneficial as we'd like it to be.
Now, Dr. Wald, you mentioned to me on the way here that one of your favorite parts, or the favorite part of working in this field, is your time spent with clients. And what you're saying is that's sort of gone to the wayside in a lot of ways.
Not so much to the wayside, but the economics of medical care, alias insurance, directs the degree to which a psychiatrist can remain involved with a patient or client, and therefore the economics of the circumstance require that the time be limited to some extent to the psychopharmacologic management. I think that's regrettable.
Seems like there's a lot more money involved in 15-minute psychopharmacological appointments than an hour with a psychiatrist doing therapy.
Well, I can't get... money is a big factor.
I mean, that's unfortunate, but, you know, I mean, it's cheaper to pay an LCSW or an LPC than it is a psychiatrist for an hour appointment.
That's true.
It's across the board. I mean, that's in medicine, too. You're not paid to sit and talk with anybody to the same degree you're paid to do procedures, although maybe payers are beginning to understand that a little bit more.
The economics make it sound like we're dealing with diamonds and rhinestones, but that's not true.
Yeah, we're human beings. We're animals, and we go where we get reinforced to go.
Yeah.
Isn't that true?
Yes, that's true.
I mean, unfortunately. And so the way I think about it, if we're going to do something about our healthcare system and the costs that are so much more exorbitant here, we've got to realign the incentives to some degree. I always thought we ought to have, I've said this a number of times in this program, we ought to have psychological insurance probably more than we ought to have physical medical insurance, because I think it's underappreciated how much it impacts healthcare costs. All right, so let's start working our way into this bipolar illness issue, and I'd like to start by talking about mood first, and maybe you can explain what mood means and why I would ask about mood when we talk about bipolar illness.
Well, I think an important distinction is between mood and temperament.
Ah, good.
Mood is a transient state of affairs, and temperament has a tendency to be more characteristic.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like your skin is either black or white, but sometimes you're sunburned.
Right. All right.
Or pale. Uh-huh. So that's mood. Mood is more of a transient, intended to be more of a transient description of behavior. Temperament is more characteristic of the person.
Mm-hmm. Both can be genetically inherited, or there may seem to be variability in mood more in certain families, is just, and temperament probably comes from families as well.
I think the discussion of whether it's genetic or environmental is worthy of more than just an hour.
Yeah.
And
always.
It's insoluble, and after many days of discussing it and conferencing it, and international specialists of all accents, uh-huh. you'll come back with the same question. Right. It's unclear how much is which.
Right.
And sometimes when we have the certainty of genetics behind us to make a statement, we still see a tremendous variability in the expression and the outcome. So that, for example, you can have parents who are diagnosed with a particular illness, like bipolar disorder, and some of their children may show it and some won't. Mm-hmm. So there you are.
I was reading about this, the genetic link of bipolar disorder, and the statistics are pretty significant in the weight that two parents who have bipolar and have a bipolar child, it's between 50 and 70% likelihood that they will become bipolar. But the other thing it said that, which was really interesting, is that families have a long history of bipolar. They also have a significant history of people who are successful and achieve lots of great things. And so it's sort of that goes back to that temperament argument. If somebody's got those skills inherently, they can either manifest in one of several ways.
Well, it's so unclear. I read that in a study. I think it was in one of the Scandinavian countries, probably Norway. A twin study, identical twins. In the case of identical twins, is 70% chance that one of the children will have a bipolar disorder when it's present at all in the family. Mm-hmm. In other words, if 100 pairs of identical twins, the frequency of bipolar disorder in that cohort hasn't been described, but there is a 70% chance that one of the twins mm-hmm. will have it and the other not.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah. Suggesting a strong genetic component, but not an overwhelming, you've got the gene, therefore you're going to get it kind of problem.
Well, I think that maybe it has to do with birth orders. A lot of things were not studied in that criteria.
It seems like we're learning that more and more, that you have that genetic risk, but it's environmental factors, whatever those might be, that may cause things to be more explicit. All right, so when we talk about bipolar disorder, how will you help our listeners and me understand what you mean? What do you envision as someone who has bipolar disorder? Before we get into children, let's just talk about it, you know, as it's best understood in the, I guess, older people.
Well, it's it's a condition in which there is a fairly continuous perspective of negativity. There's a serious depletion of happiness, and there can be mania, there can be excitement, there can be a great deal of stirring of the person, but it doesn't necessarily indicate a positive mood. It's generally negative, and it's generally disruptive of behavior and continuity of function and maintenance of relationships. So it's mostly characterized as a negative and something to be done away with. And sometimes the done away with is that the relationships break up and the person who's afflicted becomes more isolated and more embedded in their own illness. It's It's a pervasive personality instability in moods and interpersonal relationships, and its and the behavior of the individual as well as the person's self-image. So it's a big negative.
And the reason for the program today is that it's very clear, it's not just my opinion, that the diagnosis of bipolar illness has creeped down into pre-adolescence, adolescence, and even preschool age group. And I know from looking at the psychiatric literature that is a source of some concern and disagreement among the experts. You want to, is that true? And you want to explain why that might be?
Well, the term itself becomes more popular and more commonly known to people who either read or listen to the television sets, there's an inclination to describe negative behavior or misunderstood behavior of a negative sort to bipolar disorder. And once it hits the school level, teachers and other people in the school system can use that diagnosis to deal with the child who they find difficult to work with, or they can confuse it with stubbornness, they can confuse it with inadequate preparation of the teachers, as well as the particular disposition of the child. There's an inclination to maintain an attitude toward a person who shows behavior that calls attention to that particular child. And the overdiagnosis is one of the risks of having a diagnosis at our disposal.
Mm-hmm. Let me, Prentice, before you ask a question here, let me just remind listeners again, if you've got questions about pediatric bipolar illness, this is the time to give us a call. Our local number, 550-8433, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org.
The thing I wanted to touch base on is that between 95 and, say, 2003, there was a 40-fold increase in outpatient diagnosis of bipolar disorder in pediatrics, and that's young kids. And, the kids that we're talking about are the ones that are agitated and angry and really having difficulty at school and struggling with their family relationships. And I guess how much of this can be just sort of written off as bipolar disorder versus the interaction at home and school and the complexities of the genetic. But it does seem to be that there is a tendency to lump kids who are problematic without really looking at all the information.
I think that before bipolar disorder became popular language, we dealt with children who were difficult, who had pervasive negative attitudes, who had instability of mood as well as of relationships. We dealt with them as the difficult child in the family. And we endeavored to work with in psychotherapy with the parents and the child with some collaboration with the school authorities or the church. The discovery of the diagnostic category, and I have a smile on my face as I say it, changed the way in which the work was encountered and developed. Medication stepped forward to solve some of the problems of the mood instability, and in fact has been successful in doing that. And the insurance companies have stepped forward and sort of ruled out the possibility of having family therapy and other collaborative work with reference to the child with the difficulty. So the diagnosis has changed, the mode of treatment has changed, and I've lost track of the original question.
Yeah, so there's a lot that has happened. There's been this, the onset of insurance companies, the onset of needing diagnoses to be labeled, the reimbursement of medical treatment versus psychotherapies has, to a large degree, perhaps encouraged diagnoses like bipolar illness. And that's what I'm hearing you say. It's kind of, there's a lot of factors that are driving this potential overuse of that diagnostic.
Well,
label.
I'm not sure if we could say overuse.
Okay,
but it's
right.
The employment of the diagnosis.
All right. Whether it's correct or not is unclear.
That's right. The children remain. The problem remains the same. How we deal with it has changed,
mm-hmm.
and the change. In the course of my experience has been away from seeing the child as the product of a family or an embedded personality in a family,
right.
serving various functions for the family. And we used to have the concept that sometimes the difficult child was the spokesman for the unwritten feelings or the unspoken feelings of the family. And so dealing with the family and getting them involved in a more full expression of themselves would reduce the impact on the child, and we would see improvement in the child as a result of the father becoming less of a hard nose or the mother becoming less of a, mm-hmm. a difficult person in her own way.
Mm-hmm.
Those changes we can't observe anymore since we're limited to seeing the child for mm-hmm. maybe an hour every month or every 2 weeks or something ridiculous like that.
I think of, when you said the difficult child, I think of my 30 years and at one point doing parenting classes in our office. And the first time we did a parenting class, we had five or six parents whose children were all preschool and all been kicked out of a preschool already. And at that time, I was using the construct of the difficult child from a temperament standpoint. If you look at intensity of reaction, regularity of happen, adaptability to change, some of those things, you can rate those from 0 to 10. And so the kid who is, as we might say, really lets you know where he stands, is real intense in his reactions, doesn't calm very easily, doesn't adapt to new change, was more often difficult to parent or more difficult child, not bad, but really required a much more understanding environment to take advantage of those temperamental difficulties. So is temperament, are these really difficult children that may be diagnosed as bipolar or thought of as perhaps having bipolar illness now, could they be on that spectrum of difficult temperaments?
Absolutely. The child is not an innocent, neutral figure born into a pathological family. The child has its own attributes, its own difficulties. And they're not all induced by the particular family he's born into, but also by his own mm-hmm. makeup.
Right.
And there's no thorough accounting for these things.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope I didn't indicate that in our earlier diagnostic strategies we considered the parents at fault. The structure of a family is very complex, and it is not a mathematical sign of a plus or a minus,
right.
by any means.
Right. Right. Yeah, I'm afraid somebody may have thought that I understood that, and I didn't think about it till you said it, but that's not the implication. And, I mean, my thought with a difficult child is you can have a very good parent situation, and yet some children can almost break the family apart. They're so difficult to deal with sometimes.
I think that's an important distinction. I mean, not blaming the family or mm-hmm. the parents is important, mm-hmm. but there do seem to be patterns of disruptive behavior that are consistent with parenting that is less consistent and less structured and less, you know, nurturing. So there certainly are some complicating factors, and certain family dynamics contribute to mood dysregulation, temper tantrums, and things that kids have that get labeled with bipolar.
So sometimes it's not the child's behavior is nothing more than a clarification of the parents' hidden behaviors,
uh-huh.
and that those are the simple cases.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I guess the point I would like, it makes me think about, is that's where it gets down. You've got to be able to have the time to talk to families to ever pull that stuff out. And a 15-minute psychiatric medication appointment ain't going to happen.
Well, that's true.
We have a phone call. Let's take a call from Alex. Alex, what can we do for you?
Hi, my question is about the long-term effects of a child with bipolar being left untreated. And I'm thinking in particular of my son, who's now in his 20s. I believe he became bipolar when he was about 4 and had violent outbursts and attempts at self-harm and mood swings. But we did not get him treatment. And I'm wondering, because I've heard in adults that if left untreated, every episode has an accumulative effect, so that there is more likelihood that they will have future problems, more episodes, more effect on the brain. So I'm wondering, does that apply to children? If they're left untreated, does that mean by their late teens or early 20s, they're going to be worse off than ever? Does that make sense?
Well, this is Dr. Wald again. there's no set rule about it. The likelihood is untreated conditions, an untreated mood instability will be reinforced in that person. And as the instruments of expressing oneself expand with advancing age into adulthood, the pathology, as we call it, the illness itself, is more clearly shown. The fact that you suggested a diagnosis could have been made at such an early age challenges us. We don't know that we can make a diagnosis at the age of 4. We think of ourselves as being ready to look at a 9 or 10-year-old with the possibility of calling it bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. But the mood dysregulation can be as much a bad habit of your 20-year-old child as it is any true neurological pathology. And a heck of a lot of the population that walks into a therapist's office is subject to variabilities in behavior that can be treated, and they have no medical dimension to them. They're more behavioral.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, he was diagnosed with bipolar at age 19, and I always just wondered if it had been, he would have had a better time of it if he had been received treatment earlier. And I assume the answer to that may be yes.
Let me just butt in here. I would say, you know, one of the problems with that is we probably really don't know the natural history as well as we would like, since we still are struggling with how are we lumping these children very young. Are they the same problem? And so long-term answers are going to require a very precise, very consensus on the diagnosis to look at what's going to happen over time, Alex. So I can understand your desire to want to know, and I'm hopefully not hearing any feeling of guilt as many mothers have about not doing the most they could for their children.
The other thing, Alex, is that you don't know what sort of effects medicating and treating for bipolar, since bipolar is really indicated. I mean, medication is one of the main indicated treatment courses. You don't have any idea what those effects might have been on your son developmentally, his brain and all that stuff. So it's easy to look back, but things might be a heck of a lot worse if you had gone the bipolar route. It's just difficult to know.
Okay, well, I'm just glad that there's better resources now for parents who are going through this with their children than 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's an important conversation. Okay. All right, I want to remind our listening, we're gonna take a break now. I think we're about halfway through, so we're gonna remind our listeners that you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. Our local number here is 550-8433. Toll free, you can reach us at 1-888-353-5752, an email at line1alaskapublic.org. You got to line1@alaskapublic.org. You got to spell all that out. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with our guest, Dr. Robert Wald of Bridges Counseling Connection. I am your co-host, Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and I'll remind everybody, my co-host today, who you will hear intermittently, is licensed clinical social worker, Prentice Pemberton. Our guest this week is pediatric psychiatrist, Dr. Robert Wall. He has 40 to or 50 years of experience as a pediatric psychiatrist and is currently practicing at Bridges Counseling Connections here in Anchorage. And we're talking about pediatric bipolar disorder. You can reach us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local phone number, 550-8433, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And I would like to take just a short second to recognize something I just recently learned about, and then unfortunately self-promote for a second. There's an Anchorage Science Pub that I was not aware of that meets for about a year, has been meeting on the second Sunday of each month at the Taproot Public House in Spinard. They meet from 4 to 6. They have a lecture, and they have a fun time talking about the lecture and various and sundry things scientific. The reason I became aware of this is I got asked to talk, and here comes the self-promotion talk. Or part of this, I'm going to be presenting Sunday, March 10th from 4 to 6 at the Taproot Public House. And they've asked me to talk about science, or should we believe science? What I'm going to be doing is addressing what science really is. It's really a way of thinking in my part of view, and what the accomplishments may be, the mechanics of science, what's good and bad about science. But particularly, I'm interested in the where cognitive science is taking us, how we're learning about how our mind sometimes misunderstands what we're seeing, what our perception of the world really is. And I'll give you the bottom line. That leads to the fact that we really need good critical evidence to understand how the world really works. So if you're interested, that's March 10th, Sunday 4 to 6 at the Taproot Public House, and it's always the second Sunday of each month. Something the last listener said, or maybe it was you, Dr. Wall, that bad habits can be learned, and that gets to a little bit of an issue it might be worth bringing up that we talked about before the program started, and that's that the mind, our brain, is very good at learning. We learn things very well. With practice, we get better. We make less and less mistakes at it. But we also our mind is not evolved to unlearn things. A classic example I learned with my patients is we all know how to ride a bike, but we don't know how to unlearn how to ride a bike. But then I try to generalize to behaviors. If we do certain behaviors, it gets reinforced. We do it more and more. We continue to do it. So behaviors, moods, how early in life our mood gets responded to by the environment. If it's successful by having a big fit, we're likely to have more of it. Is that what you were implying?
I think so, yes. The the fact that I learned how to ride a bike when I was a kid but no longer do ride a bike doesn't mean I cannot ride a bike, but it does mean that I learned that I can learn. And to prove to myself that a task can be undertaken and achieved. Sometimes I remember that and sometimes I don't. But the fact is, I did and I can. And when we deal with a person whose behavior is pervasively negative, for example, that doesn't mean they are locked in forever with that particular skill. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They can turn things negative, but our task is to find out under what circumstances and what benefit is it to that person to be pervasively negative. Mm-hmm. And to stand by while we experience it with the person, with the trial and error of being successful and not negative, until the idea of being successful or non-negative is just as attractive as being negative.
We had an email message that I unfortunately threw into the trash a minute ago, and I'm going to try to remember it. Basically, it was a person who was unhappy about the diagnosis of bipolar was made. Medications were used. She was not at all happy about how her child acted and responded to the medication, and eventually through some psychotherapies was able to get off some of these medications. That is actually not an unusual sequence of events, it seems to me. Do you have any comments from a psychiatric point of view?
Sometimes the medication has additional effects than the one intended.
Yeah.
For example, if a medication is a mood reliever and you stop being depressed, but instead you're just exhausted all the time, you might become quite disappointed with that medication and stop using it. A better example would be if you were excitable and overstimulated and you took a medication that calmed you down, you might feel as if you were dying, and the medication would be identified as a negative, even though it calmed your mood and improved your interaction with, or at least relieved the people around you from worrying about you.
Mm-hmm.
For you, it would be a negative. I don't think of any medication that has any effect whatever on the personality or the function of the individual that doesn't have some side effects. That's part of medication.
Right. Right.
And one needs to be alert to the negatives of the medication in terms of its side effects in order to even employ it.
We had Robert Rhodes on the show a few weeks back. We were talking about adolescent mental health, and he made the comment that a lot of the kids that he sees, you know, 4 or 5 years later, they've said that they were on the bipolar cocktail is what he called it, and they've been off, you know, in their 20s, and they're doing fine, and things have turned around. So I hear what you're saying. I have heard quite often that the medications aren't working, the kids mm-hmm. seem flat, emotionless, they're
sure.
sort of lost their personality. So the medications need to be evaluated and continued to be looked at consistently.
Sometimes the medication takes the place of another person, in the sense that taking the medication permits me to behave differently. And I get reinforced for the fact that I'm behaving differently as I'm taking the medication. It might be a placebo.
Hmm.
It might be mm-hmm. a totally neutral material. But as long as it works, it works. And the working may be the taking of it.
Right.
I don't imply by that medications don't have any pharmacologic modification value, but they don't necessarily.
And I would, from the medical standpoint, I try to point out to patients and on the program that every treatment, it doesn't matter what the treatment, has risks and benefits, and you're always trying to estimate those and figure them. And each person, you have to look at it differently because each person brings their own set of clinical situation that may affect the risk. But also, it's not just the risk of the treatment. You constantly got to weigh that versus the risk of not treating. And in many of these kids, it is difficult not to try to, if not mandatory, to try to do something. It doesn't necessarily have to be medication. I don't want to necessarily push that.
I agree with that. Yes, of course. And as we mentioned earlier, the changes in the social economic application of medical care makes medication be more important.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a treatment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And rather than being part of a treatment, it mm-hmm. becomes the treatment. And what we do is we evaluate the effect of the medication, and we think we're looking at the person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good point. I have another caller. This is may also get to the issue of the difficulty of this diagnosis, but let's see what Chris has to say. Chris, what can we do for you?
Hi, I'm a retired school psychologist and had many years of going through the trying to differentiate children who exhibited a lot of acting out behaviors and concentration problems and impulsive behaviors, and trying to differentiate between whether they had ADHD or whether they were maybe a child showing early bipolar. And it made it some difference according to how they might be treated and how they might be dealt with in school. And in my own mind, I came to the conclusion that many of the children who were early diagnosed as ADHD really had a different beast, and that was probably bipolar, and the differentiation seemed to be the intensity of their responses, and particularly rage episodes and maybe some cyclic kinds of nature to their problems. But it was always a great challenge in working and trying to work the school system with the private system or the institutional system, because many times these children became so difficult at home that their families couldn't cope and they would end up with an admission into youth psychiatric facility. Right. And then we had great challenges in trying to reintegrate them back into school.
Right.
Because they were often discharged with a cocktail of medications, which frequently rendered them pretty non-responsive for being educated. the difficulty being that in an ideal world there would be time to do meetings between the school and the agency or the institution or the psychiatrist to pave the way to help this child reintegrate into a school situation, which for a kid dealing with these issues is an extremely challenging environment. But that rarely happened. And many times we would get the notice that we were receiving a kid back into school who'd been in hospital for several months. And it was, scrambling because they might not have had special services eligibility established already. And the evaluations that had been done in institution or in hospital weren't necessarily available to us in school. So, I know it's nothing, maybe nothing you could do anything about, but just a testament, another, to how the 15-minute visit,
I'd like to tell you,
plan for these kids.
Yeah, I want to compliment you. I want to compliment you on identifying in a better detail some of the issues that we all face. First of all, with regard to the diagnosis of that typical child trying to decide whether it was ADHD or bipolar, I think you had presented a case where it was probably both. And the and the treatment for each is different than the other. So the problem.
Well, and I also had the feeling that many times that the treatment for ADHD, being typically the stimulant medications, often seem to cause a breakthrough of some of the really difficult bipolar behavior.
You're absolutely right. And fortunately, now we have treatment for ADHD that is non-stimulant, which can deal more successfully with, can deal with the ADHD aspect, revealing the nakedness of the bipolar disorder, which we can then encounter, not to say that we can fix, but at least we can encounter more directly, that we have a pervasive negative instability of interpersonal relationships and self-image problems that the child has. But at least the ADHD is taken care of, and we have a kid who can potentially do better at school. You couldn't find anybody more in agreement with you about the difficulty of working with these kids and their environments. Inadequacy of the hospitalization experience is also mentioned by you, and I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, well, and it's just, I guess, the real take-home message for me is that there's no magic bullet with these kids. They're very difficult. It requires a very thoughtful and coordinated approach between the school, the families, the therapists, the psychiatrists, and a lot of times, the physician, too, who's in there as a player. And a number of the young people that I dealt with through the years that we came to believe or were diagnosed as having bipolar in school for them, it was a very rocky course. They were extremely difficult for their teachers because when they were in a bad place, their behavior was impossible to ignore. And, you know, so I really hope that, you know, whatever we come through with supportive mental health care is that we can support a multimodal kind of approach to dealing with these kids.
I agree with you entirely.
So that's all. I'll continue listening to the rest of the program with interest.
Thanks for your call, Chris.
I'd like Dr. Wald, if you could, she brought up an interesting point and you touched on it, but the significance and the importance of diagnosing if pediatric bipolar actually exists, what's the importance and significance of diagnosing it correctly versus ODD, ADHD, some of these behavioral problems which can mimic, essentially, pediatric bipolar?
That's very good. The importance of distinguishing one from the other has to do with treatment. By treatment, I mean this pharmacologic treatment as well as the treatment that's constructed in the mind of the therapist. For a therapist to think that he's dealing, or he or she is dealing, with a more embedded, permanent dispositional illness like bipolar disorder as compared to working with a child who is going through a transient transient lifetime experience based on age or the delivery of a younger child or something of that sort, with a transient behavior problem, is tremendously important. So the importance of the diagnosis has to do as much with the treatment applied to the child as it does to the disposition and perspective of the treating person. Is that an answer to your question?
Yeah, and how the family will treat that individual.
Yes.
And,
yes. To simply lay a diagnostic label on a child without reference to the sophistication, knowledge, background, intention, carry through of the parents or whoever's caring for the child is a hazardous thing to do.
It gets back to the healthcare system as it's evolved in the United States, which is not promotive of the time required to do all that and the coordination of the care that our last listener also discussed. There's often a terrible disconnect between a hospitalization, particularly psychiatric, and interaction with the private medical community and the school system.
That's right. Unfortunately, our so-called psychiatric diagnoses don't have characteristic rashes or pimples so that everybody on the outside could know what they're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be great if Dr. Woodard and Dr. Wald and myself could get together and discuss an individual case and come up with a treatment plan as a collaborative group along with their parents?
Yes, that would be great, as long as we understood that the parents were as able to implement intention as we are to apply it.
Right. Yeah. Here is a very good email. The writer says, I have an 8-year-old child whose father has bipolar 2. The father's 3 siblings all have been diagnosed with mental illness, alcoholism, and or have attempted suicide. My son seems to be going through ups and downs. And remember, he's 8 years old now. Ups and downs not related to what's going on in his life. What signs do I look for in my child that might indicate early bipolar illness? If bipolar illness is indicated, what kind of early intervention would help mitigate not only the illness, but also the negative communication and social side effects of bipolar illness?
An excellent and difficult question. The alertness that you are demonstrating by the observations you've indicated is his greatest asset. For him to be in the protective custody of an adult who is that observant is the most constructive thing that the child has going for him or her. My thought would be to continue to make your observations, to record them, perhaps even physically record them, so that when in the event that the persistence or the development of a more persistent negative attitude on the part of the child continues or is amplified, you at least have a record to share with the community of therapists that you're obviously going to get in touch with. With regard to taking precautions now, to identify the negative elements in the behavior and to counter them with clarity without argument, to offer alternatives that move away from the topic about which the negative attitude is directed. For example, if he's hostile, negative about seeing Cousin Charles, who you have to go see for some reason, you might, in fact, focus his attention on what he's going to wear and what other details can be implied by the visit rather than arguing with him about whether Charles is worthy of his condemnation or not. And by redirecting his energy to something more that has a more positive potential to it, he can learn that there are alternatives to his own behavior. He doesn't have to be told that there are alternatives, but the demonstration of your facility in creating the alternative will be helpful to him. That's a small example of what I'm aiming for.
One of the new diagnostic or the things that they're thinking about putting in the DSM-5 is a mood dysregulation order disorder diagnosis for kids who sort of are in between. Is it oppositional defiant? Is it mood disorder? Is it bipolar? And that's the thing for you to watch as the parent is to look for things like grandiosity and flight of ideas and racing thoughts and not the ability to stay up for days at a time with very little sleep and continue to function well is really a big one. But the difficulty in diagnosing bipolar is that these flight of ideas and the things that typify adult bipolar are things that kids do anyway. They can fly like Superman. They can jump off high buildings. They can, you know, all these grandiose things that we would think in adults. Kids do them anyway. They make up play, you know, mates and all these great fantasies. And that's not distorted thinking or grandiosity or flight of ideas. It's kids being kids. And the thing that I would encourage any parent to do is to discuss with their therapist and find their pediatrician and just be really, really cautious before putting medications on board with an 8-year-old.
I couldn't agree with you more. The diagnosis of DMDD, disruptive mood dysregulation disorder.
Yes, that's what it is.
Is a stepping stone before the diagnosis of bipolar is made. Bipolar just has such a ring to it of permanence and pathology that we would like to lighten it. But please don't confuse it with ADHD. They're distinctly different things. They just both cause trouble in school, but that doesn't make them the same.
Right.
We do have another email that gets to the issue. I think we've kind of beat around it. And Dr. Wall, I think you've commented on this already, but the listener may have also come in later. His question is, I've not heard the symptomatology or behavioral criteria necessary for bipolar diagnosis. It would be helpful to hear what that is. So I guess part of the issue is reminding people it's very, very difficult, maybe unclear even to the experts, of how you make that diagnosis in early childhood as opposed to older individuals. But again, you want to kind of talk about the symptomatology that would be bothersome.
Well, it's misunderstood generally, but it's a serious mental illness characterized by pervasive instability in the moods, generally negative, instability in interpersonal relationships, poor self-image, and malignant behavior or malevolent behavior. So it's generally a negative. Now, it doesn't mean that the child is acting lethargic or depressed, because it can be accompanied by extreme agitation. So hyperactivity can be accompanying all this negativity. That's one of the ways in which it's confusing. But the idea is a pervasive mental state of moods interpersonal relationships and self-image. Those are the key elements.
We have one more email, and I'm going to comment on that, and then I'm going to kind of answer that myself because we failed to tell people to go to our website, alaskapublic.org, and look at a large number of links that can help people understand this issue much more. But here's the email. The nuclear family lacks parenting role models and support it takes to raise children. There seems to be an overabundance of the diagnosis of ADHD and bipolar in the last decade. Your talk is helpful in demystifying much of this. How do we help families in whom parenting techniques being implied or the home learning environment are clearly causing children to have some learning disabilities, behavior problems, I think is what this person is trying to say. Books or local groups that would be helpful would be nice to have. Again, go to alaskapublic.org and look up line one. There's some excellent, excellent bits of information, not necessarily towards the parenting aspect, which is what this listener is hearing. They're hearing that we can affect things that might be bipolar or may be able to affect the outcome of bipolar by the parenting environment.
Absolutely. Well, what you'll find is, you know, if you can alter the parenting environment, if you can create more structure and stability and a more consistent approach to your kid and tweak your parenting style, then what you'll be left with is you'll get an idea of whether this is truly a biochemical sort of bipolar episode or one that can be modified with interventions on the home front and at school and things like that. So generally you can tell by changing up the parenting style whether there is something a little bit more severe going on.
Yeah, there is no perfect parent any more than there's any totally imperfect parent. That any exposure the parent has to their own experience with a perspective of, is there some way in which I can be more constructive to my child who will succeed me? In what way can I make this child a better person than I am? If that's the attitude, I think we're in the step, going in a step in the right direction without being too specific.
Something you said earlier today struck me also. I remember years and years and years ago, the single most important factor of the outcome of a person with cerebral palsy, a significant permanent neurologic injury, was the understanding of the parent, the home environment on that individual. And what I'm hearing you all say also is the understanding of that parent of what's really going on psychologically, emotionally, is a very, very big factor in the outcome.
What are the behaviors trying to communicate? I mean, it is the thing that I always want to ask parents. What are they trying to tell us with their behavior, that they can't regulate themselves, that they're, you know, they need more attention? There's all sorts of things.
I'll have to round it or end the program. I very much appreciate Dr. Wall being here. It's been a wonderful time. And Prentice, thanks again for taking the time to co-host with us.
Thank you.
If you'd like to continue today's conversation, you can always join KSKA on Facebook. You can find that link at our website again, alaskapublic.org. And again, share your thoughts about our program at line1 at alaskapublic.org. And also, why not tune in next week, March 4th, when we'll be discussing the health benefits of yoga. Our guest will be New York Times science writer William Broad. He's the author of the book, The Science of Yoga, The Risks and the Rewards, and Anchorage yoga enthusiast and teacher Margot Sorum. Pat Yak is vice president of public media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and helped us audio engineer today. Thanks for listening. And for Prentice Pemberton and myself, have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.